With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. I'm Ben Eshmade, and this week our archive selection finds us remembering the time Thurston Moore led an orchestra of 12 string guitarists and sonic dreamers in a symphony to the earth and the stars.
You know, I love the vibration of a city. By the 70s, the cities were sort of devoid of money and they were being shut down. And it became like this urban jungle. And in a way, there was a new culture of art and music that sort of was embracing that wildlife of the city.
Back in April 2018, taking inspiration from a poem by Sun Ra, ex-Sonic Youth musician and singer Thurston Moore brought together himself and 11 other equally genre-defying guitarists to create an orchestra, with Moore as conductor and composer. Thurston Moore's Galaxies 12x12, Music for 12-String Guitars, featured Cosmic Projections by Radio Radur and pondered our place in the universe. So, in 2018, Thurston Moore joined me over Skype from his North London HQ. You've been described as an experimentalist, composer, performer. I mean, now where you are in your career, how would you describe yourself?
Well, right now, I mean, I turned 60 this year, whether that means anything or not, but it's a nice demarcation to sort of take notice of, I suppose, personally. I've always considered myself primarily a songwriter, but I've always been very informed by free improvisation. And I like the aesthetic of free improvisation that considers that discipline to be composition anyway, but composition like in the moment, like spontaneous composition. And I sort of started playing with a little bit of anxiety when I with free improvisers in the 90s. It wasn't until the 90s that I actually started working with people in New York City. Like William Hooker was a drummer I was playing with at first. And then John Zorn sort of took note that I was interested in this music, which he was extremely devoted to. You know, and it was a real learning experience. I mean, for years and years and years of just like the different ideas that were being bandied about. And it sort of came out of my interest in radical music anyway. I mean, be it punk rock or be it just, you know, experimental music that was either academic or just sort of wild. I think I had to sort of grow into understanding that language that was always sort of a bit sort of malleable, because I felt like a lot of the ways Sonic Youth was working, we had a lot of open-ended playing that we would employ in our songs, especially live. But I never really distinguished it as a music, as a genre, like calling it free improvisation. We just called it playing, you know. We were, you know, and distinguishing it from jamming. Well, I certainly devalue the guitars in the eyes of people who see the guitar as a commodity. You can't really resell my guitars very well because I hot rod them, so to speak. I'll pull out certain electronics and just sort of, I usually get rid of the tone controls. They just sort of get in the way of the volume. I mean, that originally was what I was doing. I mean, the guitars we were using, like especially the Fender Jazzmaster guitars, a lot of their switching was sort of placed above the pickups in a way where if you weren't playing like Wes Montgomery, and if you're playing more like, say, Andy Gill, Gang of Four, you're going to be hitting those switches off and on. So we would rip those out and just wire directly to the volume pot. I don't know if it's disrespectful. I think we were just sort of, we were adjusting it to our own needs in that sense. You know, subsequently, Fender guitars did two signature guitars, one for me and one for Lee Rinaldo, that were based on how we had modified these guitars a few years back. And so that was kind of a bit of a comeuppance in that respect.
Do you have a large collection of guitars? Do you focus on the one that is like creating the sound that inspires you at the moment?
Well, I'm not a gearhead, and I've never really sort of been interested in the gear so much, even though I have, you know, a love for guitars and effects pedals and all this kind of stuff. But I'm not one who goes into every new town on tour and heads straight to the guitar store. I only need one guitar to work with, and I just find it as it's strictly just a tool for me to make sound. I've never really been into guitar lust so much, let's put it that way. The first guitars that Sonic Youth used were just like the ones we can afford at the time, which were very sort of just cheap charity shop guitars. And they didn't sound very good in sort of standard tuning. We would start tuning them differently. And, you know, these cheap guitars would break, and they would just like, the first songs we wrote were sort of dedicated to how these guitars sounded. And as soon as that guitar was malfunctioning and had to be tossed away or whatever, the song had to be tossed away. I kind of liked that in a way. There was something really sort of Buddha about that, you know? And then, you know, as soon as we got a little more work and our profile started getting a little higher and we were able to sort of have a little more coin in our pocket, one of the first guitars that we figured that we could afford were the Fender Jazzmasters. At that time in the early to mid 80s, they weren't really on the market as sort of highly collectible guitars yet. Fender does a first Jazzmaster in 1958, which I love because that was the year I was born. So I always think there's some kind of there's some kind of synchronicity there. I have a very early production Jazzmaster. I have two of those. One of them is a really wonderful guitar that was gifted to me by Patti Smith when Sonic Youth had all their equipment stolen at one point in the late 90s. She had experienced the same thing with her group, and she was playing up near where I was living at the time, and she gifted me this guitar, and it was this wonderful Jazzmaster that she had. And I think it sort of was possibly something was Fred's guitar, her husband from MC5, who had passed away. So I love this guitar, and I play this guitar all the time. And then I have one of my signature guitars as well. And then my girlfriend Eva had, as an early 60th birthday gift, presented me this wonderful Fender 12-string guitar, which I've been using to write the electric section of this piece. So, and then I have a 12-string acoustic that I've had for many years. It's a Martin, been using to write the acoustic section of the piece. So, I have a few guitars, but I have guitars sort of hanging up around our flat that Evan and I have, and they're mostly things we find in strange flea markets in our travels, you know, on tour. And so we have really strange shaped Turkish and Ethiopian ukuleles and things like this. Guitars I generally play every day, but they're just so aesthetically gorgeous and beautiful. And, you know, guitars do make good company, I think. Guitars, books, records, these things, you know, very important objects, the vibrational objects in the household.
we've started talking about it, but let's move on to Galaxies, the piece that you are writing. Were you given a blank sheet of paper? How did you sort of start?
When we had our initial meetings about doing something at the Barbican, I had worked at the Barbican in different contexts through the years. I had done this project with members of the German rock group Can. I did that. I worked with Beck there. Doing a piece that he did. Yeah, so I've become quite friendly with a lot of the good people who work there. And so we had talked about me doing something in some context. I mean, I think the original idea was like working with the London Symphonia. We talked about different ideas, and that was one of them. And I felt like I'd rather do something that hasn't been done really before. Off the top of my head, I said, how about a 12-string guitar orchestra? And we all just sort of looked at each other and smiled and realized, like, if you're going to say that, you're going to have to do it. And I immediately took the challenge. I was like, let's do it. And it wasn't until the beginning of this new year that I really sat down pen to paper and with the instruments around me and started seriously notating what I wanted to do. And it is a notation. It's composition. There are two pieces. I mean, the first piece is acoustic. The second piece is electric, separated by an intermission, and it's all of one piece called Galaxies. The first piece, the acoustic piece, I've subtitled Earth, and the second piece I subtitled Sky. And as far as that kind of text, I was just sort of looking for some sort of text idea to sort of inform me how I was feeling about writing this music, because the music was just with no lyrical content. I wanted to have some kind of language that would I could apply to it. And so I went through a lot of different texts that I was interested in, primarily poetry, like 20th century poets that I like. For some reason, I just sort of thought about the published poetry of Sun Ra, and I kind of went through some of that. And there was a very sort of beautiful piece by Sun Ra that dealt with just kind of the idea of nature, the idea of being sort of human, the idea of sort of simple togetherness that was kind of rises above a lot of the sort of miseries of that we deal with. And I thought it was a beautiful piece. And so I used it as the basis for how I wanted to enter into writing. Whatever that was sensitivity wise. It's a poem called The Satellites Are Spinning. And it goes like this. The satellites are spinning. A new day is dawning. The galaxies are waiting for planet Earth's awakening. Oh, we sing this song to a brave tomorrow. Oh, we sing this song to abolish sorrow. The satellites are spinning. A better day is breaking. The galaxies are waiting for planet Earth's awakening. Sun Ra. I just started writing and from morning to night staying indoors, which is hard for me. I like to sort of prowl around, the city. I'm a bit of a, I like sort of engaging with the city a lot. It sort of takes me away from doing work like that. I've been working pretty hardcore with it since the new year. Yeah.
You talked about prowling the city, but what's your sort of relationship between the sort of urban settings and the countryside? It sounds like you do draw inspiration, as you will, from nature.
Well, yeah. I mean, I see the cities as nature. I mean, the cities are built by humans. You know, they're all reflections of the vision of a human. So, I love the vibration of a city. I've lived rurally. I lived in sort of countryside in my day, but I'm always running to the city. I mean, in a way, I feel like it was predicated upon my teenage years and just sort of wondering what was going on in New York City and living very close to it, but not close enough where I could just walk to it. So by the time I could drive, I just went screaming towards these places that I had been looking at in these magazines, these black and white photographs of the burgeoning CBGB scene and what was going on at Max's Kansas City, and these people, who looked more like I felt than any other musicians, people like Patti Smith or Joey Ramone, Tom Verlaine, people who seemed a little
not the models of rock and roll swarthiness. That's why I think I was really attracted to the city. I think before that, you know, music culture was always about escaping to the country. You know, it was all this kind of going to Woodstock, bare feet, you know, and the commune, you know, getting away from it all, getting away from the standards of society that have been set up in the, as, you know, these cities of money. By the 70s, the cities were sort of devoid of money, and they were being sort of, they were being shut down. New York City was completely penniless, and it became like this urban jungle. And in a way, there was like a new culture of art and music that sort of was embracing that. Forget the hippies in the country. We're going to the city, and that's going to be our new world to work in. And so that, I think that's what my initial romance with the city is, that I can never sort of, you know, toss away. I've always enjoyed industrial noise. I always go towards the noise in the city. If there's some construction site around the corner, I'll walk that way. And so, yeah, I mean, to the point where it's just like, you know, what do you do with like all those industrial noise records you have? You don't really play them. there's enough raw industrial noise on the street. So when people start making records of raw industrial noise as their output, it's kind of funny. But, you know, you can't help but love it. But I never really play that music. I really loved the early days, like in the 80s, when the Ein Sturzen und Neubauten came out of Berlin. They were just so fantastic because they would come out on stage with jackhammers and, you know, in garbage bins and just throwing them around. I just thought, you know, it sounded and it looked, it was great theater. And it was the commentary on just being like of the sound of the city, you know, and putting it in a performance was just so great. They did a famous show at the ICA, where they started drilling a hole through the back of the venue, and then I wish I had seen that show. They had to be stopped. It's more about this idea of just energy and the idea of just sort of like this kind of endless cosmology that sort of that we have to sort of only wonder about, and science can take us only so far with this. And I just sort of, you know, I sort of really find some energy and just sort of that kind of, you know, the kind of mystic contemplation. And so I think about that, and I have, you know, the one thing I can really believe in is my own feelings, and that, you know, feelings that I share with other people like-minded, that there's more to existence than what we're actually able to sort of purview. So I think this electric piece is more about, there's a little more improvisation going on in this piece, you know, and the guitars are sort of creating a lot of sort of resultant sounds through this one bit of instruction that I'm giving to the musicians. And so unlike the acoustic piece, it's not such a strict composition, but it is a composition, but it's more based on instructional ideas on the page about what the musicians should be doing. It gives them a parameter to work in. If it creates any kind of visual, I would hope it would create a visual of some kind of starry sky. I found some symbology that I've attached to it, like visual symbology of like some old like Native American signs that supposedly, they do. They're emblems of the sky in a visual icon. And so I've used these or sort of on the faces of the scores for the musicians to look at, which I think at some point I'll share more readily, possibly online or as a physical score to share with people. But yeah, so that's that.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need.
Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How did you draw the ensemble together, the other 11 guitarists? Friends, musicians you admire?
Yes, both of those things. I first asked the two guitarists that I've been playing with for the last number of years here in London, James Edwards, who's a fantastic guitarist, and Deb Googe, who plays bass in our group. And as you may know, with My Bloody Valentine, she's one of the founders of at least the My Bloody Valentine we all know and love. And there's some other musicians that I've played with in London the last few years that I certainly wanted involved. David Toop was one of them, and Alex Ward was another. I asked other players. Eugene Coyne is somebody I've never met or I've yet to meet, and he's a close mate of Deb's, and she thought he would be good, and I trusted her instinct on that. And so I reached out to this gentleman, Eugene Coyne, who has a bit of a recording career of his own right. He's a very interesting musician. I reached out to James McCartney, who's a acoustic guitar player, singer songwriter, somebody I've been friendly with for a number of years, even before I moved here to London. I met him at an Altamirals parties that Sonic Youth had curated, and he was there, and we just became friendly. And this woman, Rachel Aggs, again, I've seen her play guitar, electric guitar, in a group called Trash Kit. The Joseph Coward is a guitarist who's sort of local here in North London, who I've actually played on one of his recordings, and he's somebody I've always thought was a great songwriter, and so I reached out to him. He's local. I wanted to keep it fairly local. You know, it's I didn't really think it was necessary to fly people in from all over the world to do this, or reaching out for celebrity names. Susan Stenger is a guitarist that I've known from New York City. She's been living over here for quite some time. She's a scholar of Cage's music, and she had a group called Band of Susans in New York that was coming out of a lot of the same territory that Sonic Youth was coming out of in the 70s. And Jen Chochanov, who I've yet to play with and who I've yet to meet, and again, I'm looking forward to meeting her, and she was recommended to me, checked her out, and she seemed perfect, and I gave her a ring, and she was happy to do this. And so that, I think, is it. And David Toop, you know, musicologist and, you know, really distinctive improviser, great writer, publisher of such good books as Ocean of Sound. I'm really looking forward. I mean, you know, we're going to have like three very, very involved days of rehearsals. And that's, I have no idea. I mean, I have a feeling it's going to come together fairly quickly. But at the same time, it's, you know, they are scores that each piece is about 35 minutes plus. So, I, you know, the acoustic guitar piece is going to be more of a bit of a drone pastoral with movement certainly in it. And it has a bit, it has a certainly a musical trajectory in it, and it has it's its own story. The electric piece is a bit more intensified, I would say.
I wanted to ask, and maybe this is more relevant for the electric piece, when you have 12 guitarists on stage, I presume for you it's about the smaller moments as well as the bigger moments and the peaks, the, you know, creating the shape.
Yeah, the dynamics are going to be very key in like sort of having this piece work successfully. I realized that, and I realized that just playing these pieces myself, that a lighter touch is key as well. So I'm hoping that we can sort of find the, you know, that within the ensemble to sort of keep that dynamic in check. And, you know, the last thing anybody wants to hear is just, you know, it's just a bunch of power chording. Or maybe people do want to hear that. I know that some people are like, oh, should we bring earplugs? You're going to blow the roof off the top of this place, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, well, you know, I haven't really thought about that. But I think there's a certain expectation with me coming into the Barbican with 12 electric guitars that it's going to be the searing event. Well, I guess maybe some sections can be. I haven't really heard the 12 guitars together yet. It certainly has the propensity to do that. That wasn't something I was really sort of thinking about or considering when I was putting pen to paper. It's like, oh, how am I going to like rip people's heads off with 12 electric guitars making noise? Like, should I do a feedback symphony? No, I never really thought about these things. You can rest assured there is some feedback sections. I'm not going there to create a noise storm. Let's put it that way. So there might be a taste of that. I will be conducting. I mean, I'm not going to have a baton and I won't be on a podium, but I will be sort of, I will be the one cueing. Let's put it that way. Call it what you will, but I will be the one, I am the leader. And it will be an arc of a bit of a half moon arc of the guitarist facing me. And I'm going to have a couple of maybe two of the guitarists sort of assist me in some sort of co-cueing, which I think will be necessary, especially specifically in the electric piece, which is it's divided into a group A and a group B, as opposed to the acoustic piece, which is a singular sort of ensemble piece. The electric piece is going to be two different factions working together and apart. So that's a little more work. And so I'm going to employ a little bit of assistance in that. But yeah, it will be me sort of giving the eyeball to everybody for sure.
And lastly, an interesting question, and again, this may have changed throughout your career. How do you value success? I mean, specifically with this piece, what are you looking to achieve or hope to achieve?
Well, the primary achievement for me right now is just sort of actually actualizing this piece. And it's not something I've really done before. It's sort of more concurrent with actually writing and writing a piece, writing an essay, or, you know, or writing a novella, or writing a book of poetry or whatever. So to actually write a notated composition on graph paper, it's been extremely rewarding. And I love it, you know, and I just feel like this is what I want to do now. I kind of want to sort of get more involved with doing expanded pieces of music. All of this history I have sort of informing it. And so I feel really like it's already a complete success for me. As far as performing it in public, that remains to be seen. I have nothing but confidence for it. I mean, I'm really extremely confident with the musicians I'm going to be working with. And I like the name Galaxies. I just might sort of change my name to Galaxies. We'll see how it goes. One step at a time here.
Thanks to Thurston for speaking to me and reading us that lovely bit of Sun Ra poetry. The performance itself was everything you'd expect. Equal measure beautiful, loud, and extraordinary. I'm Ben Eshmade.
Thanks for listening to this archive edition of Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast, here to inspire more people to discover and love the arts with weekly episodes of archive finds and theme series. Subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a review to help us get the word out.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.